And good morning. One further comment about remorse of conscience and its usefulness in the spiritual work. In a moment of remorse of conscience, you finally take responsibility. And in that moment, you are free of blame and self-justification, self-meritoriousness. You quit making yourself the victim. And of course, it's those three things, the two in particular, blame and self-justification, that tie us like chains to our smaller self, to our ordinary sleep, waking sleep. This tendency, to immediately go to the default position inside, I am right. And how can I maintain this fragile sense of my own rectitude? Well, you blame another. You find all these wonderful excuses why the course of conduct that you had elected was the proper and just one. Misunderstood, of course. And in our recent era, we've perfected to the nth degree this collective self-evasion in victimhood. It wasn't me. It was my group. It was my place in the birth order. It was the societal against me. It was, but whenever you have this, it wasn't me. Know that you are stuck. You have just chained yourself to the very thing that if you could unchain, would liberate you. So there's this kind of quiet, humble freedom and remorse of conscience. That all of a sudden, for a moment of free fall, you're out from under all these ways that you hogtie yourself. And there's a chance that something really new of a qualitative different order can enter. And particularly since remorse of conscience is impossible without the central participation of feeling. You can't fake remorse of conscience. That you are, by the very nature of that, up against the real scale of the thing. You see, when you step forward from this petty, petty work of defending and justifying yourself and actually feeling the sorrow of our common Father and its vast weight. It's the kind of moral equivalent to that list of new and deeper perspectives that Teilhard lists at the beginning of his chapter on seeing. To feel the weight of everything, the vastness of it, realm after realm after realm, pretty much swaps you out of the orbit of your own isolated self-importance. So it isn't common to look at self-remorse as the gateway to freedom. But I'd encourage you to work with that a little bit that way. If what you really want is to be free from your enchainment to waking sleep and to have a glimmer of a chance of tasting those other two states of consciousness that lie beyond it, these moments when we feel most flattened and incapable of keeping up the pretense are moments where we are simultaneously dropping to prostration and standing to our feet. So just to remember that as we move on our being today into our investigation. What I want to do today is to talk about a place where I think that the impact of the Gurdjieff teaching and the impact of the Teilhard teaching come very, very close together in the heart. If you could weigh the valence and the fragrance of the things, what is so precious and tender in the Gurdjieff teaching about conscience is really matched in intensity by what Teilhard has to say about the personal. And when you sift through the outer structures and filters of the work, if I would have to bear, filter it down to one heart gift from each of these seeing visionaries, from Gurdjieff I would hold conscience, from Teilhard I would hold the personal. And so today we're going to explore in the morning what Teilhard means by the personal. And then in the afternoon, I want to go hunting for the well-buried sources of the personal in the Gurdjieff work, because I think they're both, once again, reverberating with the same basic cosmic vibration. Anyway, toward the end of his life, Teilhard said to one of his younger Jesuit friends who became his biographer, God is a person. God is a person. God is a person. And to hear that statement tumbling from the lips of a 70-year-old paleontologist who has taken the broad view of everything, you wonder at first, well, is this a regression to childhood? But Teilhard was very, very insistent. God is a person. God is a person. God is a person. And I think we have to give him the benefit of the doubt that he didn't mean that God is a little old man with a beard. But his understanding of the absolute uncollapsible importance of the personal as the heart of the heart of the evolutionary principle, as the linchpin to everything, I think has been persistently undervalued and underrecognized in his teaching, and certainly in the modern iterations of it where they simply, sort of skim off his ecological model, separate it from what is looked to be his quaint vestigial Christian mysticism, and wind up secularizing him. The personal holds an extraordinarily important role in the teaching of Teilhard, and through his teachings on it, we're each invited to come to terms with what the personal means in our own life, to be in personal relationship with the love that moves the sun and the stars. Cosmogonic love. What does this mean in your life? Is this just another data? Or is this something that actually melts everything? Let's look. So, the contrary to prevailing opinion, Teilhard insisted that as we move what we call, forgive me for the moment, higher up the evolutionary ladder, that the realms do not become less personal. They become more personal. And this flies in the face of most of the kind of teaching that you receive out there, certainly in Ken Wilber and the popular models of it, that what you pay, the price you pay to enter the quote-unquote non-dual realms, is that you give up your attachment to the personal. The non-dual realms are considered to be impersonal, transpersonal, you know, two variations on the same coin, but that the realm of the personal God is generally ascribed on the Ken Wilber evolutionary maps to a more immature stage in the journey, to the remains of an ego that needs to think of a Papa God, and that as you become really mature in your non-dual vision, the theory goes, you have to sort of put away childish things. And that the realms are characterized by this sort of Himalayan disregard for the personal, but meanwhile you've already seen through the illusion of it, so you're good to go. That's the map. Certainly when I went to first begin to spend some time with Thomas Keating during the 1990s, and the evolutionary models were sort of falling into currency, this is what I would call a classically westernized version of an Eastern understanding. Teilhard, though, you know, this is very much the counter. This is the current still prevalent intellectual model. My friend, the Cedar Rapids Buddhist, alleged to earlier in this teaching, used to say, well, you know, theism is an immature stage of consciousness. And as you move toward the non-dual, you graduate and you begin to see that God is not a person. God is at very most the interdependent arising of all things. Teilhard said no. As we ascend the ladder of evolution, or as you put it in more Teilhardian language, as evolution converges towards its omega point, the realms necessarily become more personal. And he has very good reasons for saying that. Again, deriving from this model we looked at yesterday himself, his two-pronged inner hermeneutic. That first of all, he sees it as a logical projection of the things he's seeing from his scientific training, from his calculations, and supports it scientifically. He has good reason to say, from on the basis of the model that he's laid out, that the realms must necessarily become more personal. But he also supports it, as we saw yesterday, from the central experience that his own encounter with the most profound, the most alive, the most transfiguring presence in the cosmos is in the realm of the person. When he talks about Christ as the fire of his heart and the emergence of Christ, he's talking about the emergence of the personal. So because he can both project this with his mind and feel it with his felt sense, aliveness, he says, it's true, it has to be more personal. So we're going to look at that map and see how, to what extent we're comfortable with his calculations here. First of all, and really, really important to note, that Teilhard was the first, so far as I can ascertain, to draw a very clear distinction between personal and individual. That delineation has since become more current in the culture. You'll find it in Thomas Merton. You'll find it, God knows, in Beatrice Bruto. It's foundational to her work. But Teilhard was the first one to name it, and he names it in Phenomenon of Man-Human Phenomenon in a way that has since passed into the culture for those that are paying attention. He says, he's talking about, once again, this tension that he's talked about, this apparent tension between the individual and the whole, you know, we've mentioned that, we'll come back to it again. He says, egoism, whether it be individual or racial, is justifiably intensified by the idea that in fidelity to life, the element rises to the extremes of uniqueness and incommunicability it possesses within itself. It thus feels right. In other words, that our journey to full self is a matter of individuation, which means making yourself more and more unique, more and more different, more and more Enneagram 4-ish for those of you that like that. You just don't understand me because I'm totally different. It's an idea that took root in the West and came to its fruition in the 19th century in Romanticism, you know, where you look at Whitman, Byron, those kinds of people, as, you know, the individual being consummate idiosyncrasy, you know, the incommunicability of my particular essence. And we've all been drenched with this model, and Teilhard calls the question on this. He says, it feels right. Its only mistake, but a fatal one that leads it to go astray, is to confuse individuality with personality. In trying to distinguish itself as much as possible from others, the element, the individual person, individualizes itself, but in doing so, it falls back and tries to drag the rest of the world backward toward plurality and into matter. In reality, the element diminishes itself and becomes lost. To become fully ourselves, it is in the opposite direction we must advance, in the direction of convergence with all the rest, toward the other. The end of ourselves and the culmination of our originality, hear origin in that, originality, is not in our individuality, but in our person. And according to the evolutionary structure of the world, the only way we can find our person is by uniting with one another. Now, that paragraph, that's page 187, if you've got the human, that's worth trying to... you know, really spending some time doing Lectio Divina with that one. Because I think he's just named what may be the fatal culture of our own particular strain of the modern world. Now, I think clearly in hospice care, the fate to be determined in some ways by the upcoming election. But look at it. In trying to distinguish itself as much as possible from others, in other words, to claim its identity on the basis of what separates it from others, what sets it apart, the element, in trying to distinguish itself as much as possible, the element individualizes itself, but in so doing, it falls back and tries to drag the rest of the world backward toward plurality and into matter. In other words, there's a tendency towards mitosis. And if, as Teilhard says, the whole struggle for 14 billion years has been between the unorganized multiple and the coherent multitude, you know, that we have to begin to... That's a backward direction. That it results in splitting, like split ends of hair. And of course, this is where Gebser comes in and says, well, this is a predictable outcome of the deficient mental structure at the end of its cycle. It turns on itself and begins cutting its own ground into smaller and smaller bits. It's a kind of compulsive, knee-jerk reaction of a middle structure which has lost the plot, which no longer has the energy of evolution flying through it. But Teilhard was the first to name this, you know, that to the mental egoic mind, to waking sleep, to to ordinary consciousness just by the virtue of how you work. Your individuality is that which distinguishes you from everybody else, which sets you apart. And we begin this training even early for people in elementary school. It's Billy's week to be special. And you go home and you bring in pictures of your family and of your cats and of your awards and the reinforcing training that what makes you special is what defines you over and against the whole. It's so entrenched in our culture nowadays that we almost can't see it any other way. And the word individuate, you know, can too easily be interpreted that way, although Jung meant something very different by it. Let's go find our particular little set of characteristics that makes us us. Let's hang on to them, let's nurture them, let's burnish them and polish them, and let's not let anybody else steal them or take them away, because then they're diminishing our identity. That's a modern compulsive. It's a modern fixation. And Teilhard named it. An individual is one who lives in isolation from the whole and in implicit competition with the whole. So that my being is achieved the more space I take up. And the space I take up is achieved by the diminishment of your space. It's implicitly a destructive model. The person is one who knows in a mysterious way that their identity is conferred within a relational field. And it's only within a fluid, permeable relationship, interpenetrating, supple with the whole, that your true personhood sparkles like light hitting a snowfield. You know, it's not a permanent possession, but it becomes very, very rich and real within a relational field. And in this, the parts are in some sense interchangeable, and yet they are inhabited by the personhood of whoever lives in those parts. I'm thinking a little bit last night about if I really wanted to be a work, monster in the good old style, halfway through the mass of the world, I would have said, okay, John and Ben, switch parts. And I'll bet you in the state we were in last night, they could have done it on the spot. So that nothing would have been lost from either one's beautiful inhabiting of the part. But there would have been a flexibility. The swap would have happened because the personhood was so flowing. And they would have had different flavors. What do you think? Could you have done it? Wipe that horrified look off your face, Ben. You're betraying yourself as an Episcopal priest.
I'm saying yes.
Yeah. No, it's a rare illusion. Yeah. It's a rare moment when things are so flowing from a higher synergy that they overpower our individual boundaries without destroying them. So, does this make any sense to you? Can you begin to wrap your mind around this difference that Teilhard was the first to name to distinguish him? Merton got right into it. He saw that really individuality was the final fruit and consummation of the ego self. In other words, a massive cul-de-sac. Whereas personhood was the gateway into something that the Christian tradition has known as the mystical body of Christ. The capacity to form a higher unit in which everyone receives their identity in and through the part, but not in a kind of mechanistic conformity, but that their own personal uniqueness becomes the container in which this fluid, you know, this more fluid substance shines. So to try, yeah, Joan?
You know, I just think that you just named such a difficult leap. I really like the way Gebser describes that intersection because we're so afraid we just have to fall back into this, what we know of ourselves. He says on 123, as it, the perspectival world, developed over the centuries, the state of affairs gives rise to the most destructive of the stigmas of our age. The universal intolerance that prevails today, the fanaticism to which it leads. A person who is anxious, or who is fleeing from something, or who is lost, either with respect to his own ego or with respect to the world, it holds equally true in both instances, is a person who will always be intolerant as he feels threatened in his vital interest. He quote-unquote sees only a vanishing point lost in the misty distance, the vanishing point of linear perspective of which Leonardo once wrote, and he feels obliged to defend his point fanatically, lest he lose his world entirely.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Exactly. That could be a...
It's terror. It's terror.
Yeah.
The terror of the situation.
The terror of the situation. Would someone please post that on the Wisdom School community page as the fruit of day 5 or is it day 6? Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's where the rubber hits the road. You know, the end point of that kind of development lies in that utter alienation. And Gebser names it and Teilhard sees it. You know. And I would just say for those of you who have worked long decades in the Gurdjieff work, what Gurdjieff means by permanent individuality has nothing to do with the ego writ large. It's not that. And I think it's a classic mistake that a lot of people in the work make, unless another element works in, because if you work with just directly your sense of ego self, I am present, and your will, and your aim, and your success in the aim, then what begins to develop is more and more a reification of a powerful individual, but still separated. And this is a thread that Gurdjieff saw beyond, obviously, but that many of the groups don't see, because as I'm going to argue tomorrow, they don't allow in the critical transformative element. It's received underplay in 50 years or so of articulation of the work, partly because it's not controllable exactly, you know. It has to come, but it tends to. Anyway, we will pick that up later. It's searching for analogs that allow us to begin to picture this idea. Teilhard turns to the concept of erotic love as our first foretaste in life, you know, of what he's actually talking about. The willing giving up of individuality for personhood and knowing the difference. So he says that this is exactly what happens in love. When you truly meet one who becomes your beloved, that there's a deep, immediately what ends is individuality and what begins is personhood. And he talks about it this way. He says, Love alone is capable of completing our beings in themselves as it unites them. So that would be a paradox to our mind, but we know that if you've ever been in love. For the very good reason that love alone takes them and joins them by their very depths. And this is, in fact, a daily experience. For actually, is not the moment when two lovers say they are lost in each other, the moment when they come into the most complete possession of themselves. And if you can hang on to that experience in your own day-to-day bank of lived experience, you actually have everything it takes to get to the bottom of this mystery. Way back earlier on, Soloviev, in his beautiful sort of philosophical reflection on love, said that the importance of love, and he's talking about romantic or erotic love, is that it forces us to accord to the other the absolute right and central place that we usually in our own only give to ourselves. It creates the conditions of true dynamic reciprocity. And a relationship dies when those conditions are no longer accessible to either party. But as long as it is, it's calling us into a fundamentally different sense of being. And in that being, we discover that there is not simply an I and a thou, but also an us that's different from either one of them in their individuality, stronger and new and fresh, and that into this one willingly surrenders one's precious individuality, one's well-defended boundaries, for the taste of the flow and the truth that comes through the greater unit, the emergence of the new. And in that kind of love, Teilhard sees so clearly, we have a foretaste of the higher and realized love that he's talking about, and will be talking about increasingly as he talks about the amorization of the universe as we move closer and closer to Omega Point. But that this love, this becoming deeply yourself, unfolds in the realm of the personal. And that, you know, go back and check your own experience with love if you doubt it. So that's point A. He can then go on from that fairly simply to say that love is therefore the evolutionary principle. Because it alone, again based on this kind of icon of what happens to two beloveds who really, truly touch the marrow of each other, what happens is that you begin to discover from the inside the basic principle of complexification consciousness, that unity differentiates, differentiation unifies. That, and of course Rilke was onto the same point in that beautiful, beautiful reflection in Letters to a Young Poet, where he says to truly love another is not the task of the young. It requires a lifetime, because he says there's a tendency to merge prematurely and let the whole thing collapse into codependency. But he says that the real fruits of love are when someone has brought forth something in themselves, has called forth a being, an essence, an when one has, in that sense, individuated, and it's those that can flow together. And what flows together is not a muddy watercolor picture, but a paroxysm of harmonized complexity. And we know this. Again, taking your touchstone in a memorable personal experience of love, you know that in a healthy love, in a healthy partnership, a healthy marriage, the two partners, in deferring 100% to each other, don't become less themselves. Somehow, in a funny way, they become more themselves. Drawing from the strength of the us, the higher unit, and the strength of the love itself, to plunge deeper and deeper into the mystery of himself. This is what Teilhard really means by unity differentiates, and differentiation unifies. And it's why when he talks about love as an evolutionary force, he's not just saying something like, let's all just get together and love one another. You know, he says that love is seeded through the whole cosmos, and that it manifests first as the simple physical force of attraction, drawing things toward convergence. You know, he's got this wonderful, wonderful quote, one of my favorite jaw-droppers in the whole book. In all its nuances, love is nothing more or less than the direct or indirect trace marked in the heart of the element, in my own heart, by the psychic convergence of the universe on itself. It's an extraordinary comment.
What page are you on?
I'm on 188. In other words, that thing in me that calls me to love, to fall in love, to step into love, to seek union, to seek the companionship of the other, is simply a reverberation in my musculature, in the marrow of my being, of this original, what he calls, summons from Omega Point to converge. And remember that convergence is the fundamental evolutionary condition for Teilhard. Nothing happens when we all remain separate, when we all do our own little dance. It's as we are able, in some senses, to come together under the tension and pressure of confinement, that this other possibility emerges of a greater self-articulation in the union. And for Teilhard, that's the principle top to bottom. It's the drive shaft to a happy marriage, and it's the cosmogonic drive shaft. And the two are in each other holographically, like the drop in the ocean and the ocean in the drop. Does that make sense at all? So this is the basis on which, there's a lot of work that needs to be done still on Teilhard's understanding of love, as well as Gurdjieff's. And maybe in a year or so I can come back and have something semi-intelligent to say about that. It's a huge topic. It's a huge chasm that opens up in the heart to fall into it. And it doesn't work to do it like even wonderful people like Nivea Delio do. It's too superficial. You know, she quickly switches tracks between all these nice things we learn about nuns, about love when we're nuns, to the raw force of this cosmogonic principle, which is untidy and fiery. But the love that Teilhard is actually talking about, if we could begin to explore the pieces of that, we could see how he says that the structure of the universe, the structure of the cosmos, is love. And I think we might finally fall to our knees with authentic remorse. I don't see it yet, but I see where it's to be seen from. Anyway, work on that part of the equation, and that will already give you good work. But there's another piece now that I want to throw out to you. You know, we got the hands, now let's put in the feet.
Gospel
equally. Oh, yeah. Now, three conscious breaths and jump out the window. Where does the whole thing buckle? But the other fork I want to walk down now is that love is also it makes possible the transfiguration, the alchemy of the being, in the only mode, in the only real format that it can happen, which from a religious point of view is in devotion. That it's only the fire of love expressed in words such as adoration, devotion, oblation, that carries the force of that heart yearning, that feeling yearning, to a strong enough heat and intensity to melt the chains of egoism in a person. So I want to talk a little bit about the uncollapsible, you know, the non-negotiable importance of devotion in a path of transformation. It's that which, analogous to the, you know, gazing upon the beloved for the first time, swats the heart out of its habitual organ, you know, orbits of egoism, and allows us to open to remorse of consciousness, to something qualitatively greater than ourselves. And Teilhard sees this really, really cleanly. He points out on page, let's see, 190 in this, my notes to myself say that he says, and that devotion requires, this is the real point, devotion requires the continuation of the personal, the realm of the personal. Because devotion does not happen out of and apart from the realm of the personal. So the two are joined at the hip. The fire of transformation heated up enough to begin to catalyze that sacred alchemy of your being, which catapults you beyond egoism, will be generated only in the flames of devotion. And the flames of devotion cannot be generated in any realm but the personal. Sufism 101. But so, for me, so true, and I want us to consider this a little bit more, because this brings us right to that head-on-head impasse between the current models that say non-dual transfiguration requires leaving the personal, and the other models say, it requires an intensification of the personal, but a whole new transfigured level. And how you walk that choice, a lot will fall out. So Teilhard says, naming this, he says, collectivity itself is fundamentally unlovable, and this is where philanthropy fails. Common sense is right. It is impossible to give oneself to an anonymous number. Let the universe take on ahead of us a heart and a face, become personified for us to speak, and then in the atmosphere created by this focal point, the elementary attractions will unfold. Collectivity as such is fundamentally unlovable. This is where philanthropy fails. Common sense is right. It is impossible to give oneself to an anonymous number. Let the universe take on ahead of us a face and a heart, become personified for us, so to speak. And then, in the atmosphere created by this focal point, the elementary attractions will unfold. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a very fascinating comment. Mm-hmm. Like all these great spiritual propositions, not a truth to be written down in a book, but a wager to be lived. But I think I might start to ease into this by sharing a story from my own childhood. That I was raised for the early years of my life until I was old enough to rebel conclusively in Christian Science. And Christian Science was one of those great religions, still is, of the new thinking of the late 19th century. And it attempted to impose a scientific and transpersonal veneer upon the jumbled and distorted and overdramatic devotional forms that the founder of this religion, Mary Baker Eddy, found both reprehensible and ineffective. And by returning it to a more scientific basis, allow us once again to have access to the methodology of healing. So as a child, I never learned God is great, God is good. I never learned have mercy on me, a sinner. I learned there is no life, truth, intelligence, or substance in matter. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. Spirit is immortal truth, matter is mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal, matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God and man is his image and likeness, and therefore, I forget what the therefore is. Oh, therefore man is not material, he is spiritual. Well, from that I'm supposed to fall to my knees and pray? This set of metaphysical assertions of the supremacy of my higher nature and the illusoriness of my lower nature for a 7-year-old who's lying in her bed about to throw up because she has a stomach ache, and you've been taught that if you can just say this statement, the illusion of your illness will disappear. These vast, pitiless cosmic statements were the landscape of my early childhood, punctuated only by the fact that they had the goodness to send me to Quaker schools, not because of anything heroic about their being, but because they didn't want me in schools that were integrated. Another chapter of my life. But I would sit in meeting for worship and there discover in my own heart a different feature of God. But these great statements. And I remember one day when I finally hit high school, I joined the choir and began to discover in the singing, we had a very good music teacher and who presented to high schoolers, teenagers, some of the really serious pieces of the choral literature, and in this particular year we were working on the 4A Requiem. And I was already wrenched by the simple beauty and feeling that went through this piece. It's like something that had not been born in me was beginning to wake up. And then, as it turned out, when I was, you know, in that particular year, one of the kids of the choir, a kid named Harry DeSabatino, the class below me, got killed in a car crash. Just about the time we were scheduled to do our performance of the Forme Requiem, and his parents requested that we do it as a mass at his church, not as a performance mass, but as part of the actual mass for celebrating and grieving the departure of his life. And there I was. It's one of my first times at a Catholic church, and I was pretty scared, I tell you. But to sing this and to watch the simple transaction of comfort in human grief, not a dismissing of the whole thing with metaphysical principles, but a realization that people hurt at this point, and that through the gateway of that, their solidarity and that pain, a beauty can enter that is the real healing. And I watched it, and my heart made a turn in my journey. Many years later, my parents had some good friends, still Christian Zionists, who had a small airplane, single engine airplane, and they were all going to go up for this big party and go flying. And the next day, I wasn't living at home by then, but they came home and I heard this dread silence. How was your flying trip? Then my little brother came into the room and threw in my parents' place the obituary for these people who had been killed at takeoff in this airplane. And my parents could say nothing, because in Christian Science, death is the ultimate affront against practice. You know? That you've given in to your materiality. You have failed to substantiate that man is not material, he is spiritual. So there was no services of mourning. No collective grief, no adoration, no Eucharist, God knows. So I knew in my heart of heart then, although I couldn't put the pieces in, that what had happened in the realm of the personal, funky though it may have been, insulting to my higher cosmogonic senses, was nonetheless true and real. Ken Wilbert sidled back to that many, many years later when he wrote as a little sort of sidebar almost in Integral Spirituality about spirit in first, second, and third person. First being I, third being it, second being thou. And he said that, you know, most of the great non-dual religions will do either spirit in first person or spirit in third person. First person is the Atman, is Brahman. I, myself, am contiguous with this great infinite chain of being. Third spirit in third person is what we got in Christian Science. God was a bunch of principles, all ending with I-O-N or I-S-N, a bunch of nouns. Man is not material, he is spiritual. There is no life, truth, intelligence, or substance in matter. All is infinite mind. Okay, bring in my kneeler and show me where I kneel before infinite mind. You know, the collectivity is fundamentally unlovable. So, Ken was picking up that it's only in the second person, the I, thou. When God becomes the beloved, or when you become the beloved of a beloved, that something happens that essentially gets you out of the trick of mistaking that I of your little small self for Brahman, God forbid. Mm-hmm. I, Brahman, you know, at which point you get the Superman of Nietzsche or people like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets you out of that. Or it gets you out of this sort of mental rational control, the clockwork, the God is a principle, is a God, you know, that, and I with my objective consciousness can behold that principle. Good, but it doesn't transform. That's what Teilhard says. The fire is in the devotion. So, one could say that Ken Wilber comes around to understanding the transformative impact of the personal. In his book, that of the 20 or 30 or 40 of them he's written at this point, the one that really stands out as qualitatively different from all the rest, Grace and Grit, which tells the story, the agonizing story of his wife's journey through cancer, discovered just about the time they get married, and for 5 years, for the entire 5 years of their marriage, it's spent with her gradual sinking beneath the seas of breast cancer. And he tells one session in the book particularly where they've gone to Germany for a last round of really brutal chemotherapy, a chemotherapy that virtually, you know, kills the cancer maybe 30 seconds before it kills you. So really toxic. And she initially responds well, and then she doesn't. And Ken is fighting back these overwhelming waves of knowing where they are that he's trying to fight down with his spiritual practice, and finds himself wandering to a bar on a Sunday afternoon, and there's some old German guys that are in there drinking and dancing. And they look at him in the corner, sitting there, you know, just lost in the profundity of his unacknowledged grief, and say, and pull him over, and keep pumping beer into him, and hold him up finally, as they just dance the circle dance. Mm-hmm. And he says that for all his many years and years of decades on the meditation mat and learning the truths of the, you know, that I am not it, that the moment that it broke through to him and that he accepted what he knew and stood in grief before it was in the hands of these old German guys, skunk drunk, dancing in this circle. They reaching out intuitive comfort to a stranger whose grief they didn't even know why. Profound moment. Oh. So, for Teilhard, seeing this, the role of devotion, and I think we need to say right off from the start that devotion is not always manic. It doesn't mean weeping in tears and flailing yourself around. That's only Italian devotion. Devotion can be laser like fire. Devotion can be the Sufi. Dervish Turner. I was telling people last night about my friend Jade Garland, who's a Sufi in Vancouver. And the head of their order, you know, the order was stationed in North Carolina, and they were building a new kind of little teke to dance in and to worship in. And so, like most sort of cheap building nowadays with prefab structures, they build it on poured cement pilings. And the pilings, you know how they make the pilings? They have these cardboard tins and you pour concrete into them, and then you stick a spike into the middle of it so you can tie the building down onto it. So they're about this big, maybe slightly bigger, but not as big as this. And the Sufi teacher looked at my friend Jane, who had become an awesome turner, and said, "Well, as we consecrate the building, you get up there and turn on that foundation post." So there it is, this big with a spike in the middle of it. Any kind of thought at that moment that dervish ecstasy is just throwing yourself out, you know, still point in the turning world. Mindfully aware that one false move and you've just punctured your foot or died. And yet knowing that, not to obsess over it. Mm-hmm. So that all of the energy is concentrated in the devotion, in that rope of Allah, mm-hmm. which is the spine, the cosmic spine of dervish turning. That's devotion. Quiet. Not just the flames, but the blue of the flame. So you can find it in any mode, and essentially you must. But to eliminate it, by eliminating the personal, really guarantees that this ultimate fusion that we're talking about can't happen. It's easily overlooked that if, as I believe, remorse of conscience is actually the linchpin in this whole Gurdjieffian teaching, which you can read between the lines in the way it comes back again and again and again in the Asyata Shemash teaching, and it's the piece of hope he gives us, that the possibility of our connection with objective conscience has not completely atrophied in us, that it can be called out. That's the hope. But if that's the case, and if it's awakened by remorse of conscience, as we read yesterday, and if remorse of conscience, if the seeds of objective conscience are actually the particles of the emanations of the sorrow of our common Father, this pretty much clinches the case that remorse of conscience can only take place in the realm of the personal. Is that how I get there? That you change one word in the obligality and strivings, and you change the whole thing. To hasten as quickly as possible to pay the cost of your arising, so in order to be able to lighten the sorrow of infinite mind. It doesn't compute. You don't prostrate yourself before infinite mind or any of the other great isms by, it just doesn't capture that dimension, that crucial element of the self-donation of the heart, which is the crowning jewel of the realm of the personal. And Teilhard's beautiful understanding here that leads you right into, if you've got a kind of Christian hankering in your body, you know, some vestigial mysticism you haven't dealt with yet, that where he says, collectivity as such is fundamentally unlovable, and this is where philanthropy fails. Common sense is right. It is impossible to give oneself to an anonymous number, to a noun, to a concept. Am I going to give myself to infinite mind? I think not. Haven't managed to in all these years. Just as life as I enter the nuptial chamber, I'm not going to give myself to the concept of orgasm. Let's get a life.
Self-improvement's masturbation.
Right, there you go. Let the universe take on ahead of us a face and a heart. Become personified for us, so to speak, and then in the atmosphere created by this focal point, the elementary attractions will unfold. So what is the incarnation? If not the human, if not the universe taking on ahead of us a face and a heart. And the necessity, if you want to look at Jesus in no other way, then as the universe taking on a face and a heart, so that in the realm of the personal, the human being can surrender themselves to the reality of the alchemical flames of love that will take them beyond their egoism. And I think that's the gambit. That was certainly the experience that was the touchstone and the tie rod in Teilhard's life from first learning the sacred devotions of the Sacred Heart of Christ on his mother's knees, right up till the end, where he says that since through all my life I have sought you, Lord Christ, in every way of my life, when death closes my eyes, may I surrender myself even more fully into you. Dying on Easter Sunday is one wish. That's a little bit of the personal, and it makes sense then of this mysterious comment that I alluded to earlier but didn't jump on, when Teilhard is talking in one of these early reflection passages in his book about the ways of life, and perhaps we can hear this a little bit differently. He's talking about the ways of life are profusion, ingenuity, and finally, he lists indifference to the individual. This is one of the characteristics, and he writes about it, and this is one of my most favorite arresting passages, 67 for those that are following. So many times, art, poetry, and even philosophy have depicted nature as a woman blindfolded, trampling down a dust of crushed existences. In life's profusion, we find the first traces of this apparent hard-heartedness. Like Tolstoy's grasshoppers, life passes over a bridge of accumulated corpses. Life is more real than lives, as it has been said. In other words, the life force sort of goes blindly on at the expense of individual beings. And if you take a certain bird's eye view, you can see this even in the pandemic now as it rares up again. You know, it's easy to say, well, there's going to be a harvest. The human race needs pruning, and since it refused to prune itself through birth control or other moderations, you know, and since its egoism has gotten more and more invasive and out of bounds, boom. So it's easy to say that. You say, yeah, that makes sense. And then the faces come to you. The ones you've lost. The ones you put at risk. The ones you read the Mass of the Dead over. It's that antennae, that fundamental, you know, tearing of your heart between what a higher perspective can see as right and just and what the lower perspective, but still true, registers as infinitely personal grief and loss. So he goes on to say, here lost in number, there torn apart in the collective, there again in a third direction, stretched out into becoming, the dramatic and perpetual opposition in the course of evolution between the element, the little one, born of the multiple, and the multiple constantly being born of the element. Insofar as the general movement of life becomes more ordered, in spite of periodic resumptions of the offensive, the conflict tends to resolve itself. Yet it is still cruelly recognizable right to the end. Only from the spirit, when it reaches its felt paroxysm, will the antinomy clear and the world's indifference to its elements be transformed into an immense solicitude, immense caring, in the sphere of the person. So, as we converge on the Abega point, for Teilhard, it must become more personal. Because it's only here in the personal, in the realm that is infused and suffused by love in its capacity to unify in diversity and differentiated unity, that the apparent conflict between the whole and the part can find its resolution. And following that intuition from Teilhard, when I came to Eye of the Heart and writing a little recapping the age-old esoteric maps of the worlds, my own seeing says that the world of the Christic, I assign that, you know, instead of putting Christ consciousness up here as a kind of non-dual, I made this world 12, and it's the center of the world of the personal. Because it's from there that Christ and this whole triumph and healing of the antinomy happens. It's here that from the fires of Eros, the light of Agape is extracted, that individual and collective are brought into reconciliation. And it's also from this realm that we can directly receive, just barely, the suffusions of a kind of love that is not simply a universal principle of love. You know, the damnably frustrating and brilliant thing about love is there is no universal principle of love. It's all hogwash. It's multi instantaneous, repetitive, complete particularizations of love. And in that form, and only that form, it reaches us, respecting our own particularization and calling it forth into the holy conjunction with the all. So, a little bit of Teilhardian thinking on that. We'll go back this afternoon and look a little bit more closely at where the personal hides of the Gurdjieff were. And I want to look a bit about the systematic impersonalization of the work almost from the get-go, and where the opportunities are, I think, to unlock a potential that has been touched in it. It's touched frequently, but it was touched most profoundly, I think, in Paris in the late 1940s. When Gurdjieff just sort of, for whatever reason, gave up the theories, gave up the pedagogies, and simply and concretely generated and transmitted a quality of love which still reverberates into this day. So we'll look a little bit there, and then we'll see where else we go this afternoon. Anyway, let's take a minute and remember the task. And if any of these insights remain with you, let them infuse these words, Gospodi, Pobinu, Lord have mercy.